Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. Newsrooms in New Mexico rarely reflect the diversity of the communities around them, and journalists of color across the country are calling out racism in their industry. This morning, we will hear from veteran New Mexico reporters and media educators who are challenging the status quo. And we want to hear from you. What do reporters get wrong about your community? You can call in this hour at 277-5866, tweet to us using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM, or email letstalk@kunm.org. And before we start, I do want to acknowledge my own position as a white male within a media institution, KUNM, that has been led and staffed by mostly white people historically. We in the newsroom are talking about these dynamics and considering what has to change for this media outlet and the profession to better represent our audiences. So we're going to begin today's conversation with Roberta Rael. Roberta is the executive director of Generation Justice, a multiracial, multicultural project that works with New Mexico youth in areas including media justice to ready them for future leadership. And they also produce the Generation Justice program, which airs Sunday evenings at 7 on this station. Good morning, Roberta.
Buenos dias, Ty. Buenos dias desde Dios to our listeners.
Thank you so much for being here. So tell us about the young people that Generation Justice works with and why media justice is an important component of that curriculum.
Well, Generation Justice works with all young people. We are very intentional about making sure that we are representative of the community that we serve and that we look and sound and understand the community that we serve. So that is why we're multiracial and multicultural. We have young people from the ages of 13 all the way to mid-20s, about 25, following the public health definition of young people when a human being's brain reaches full development. And we work in a number of areas with young people. We provide them with hard skills and essential skills to become the leaders that we need in New Mexico and in our world.
And how do you use the idea of media justice to help these young people learn about leadership?
Well, media justice means that definitely they're also being trained as journalists, and we certainly have many young people who are professionally working successfully in the field of journalism. But we want to have young people understand that that if we're serving our community, first of all, the airtime that we have is not our airtime, it's the community's airtime. And that the way we distribute time is really based in building community and building relationships. But also that there's no such thing as the false narrative of the voiceless. A lot of times you'll hear, media folks or journalists or other leaders say, well, we're giving voice to the voiceless. Well, we don't believe that there's such a concept as human beings that are voiceless. It's just that the frame really is that they haven't been allowed to tell their stories in their own voice and been allowed the platforms to and the time to tell their stories. And so that's a basis of the training of media justice. Media justice is absolutely grounded in social justice, and you will never have, or we will never have, social justice without racial equity and gender equity.
So can you tell me a bit about racial equity and gender equity in mainstream media as we understand it now, and how your program is working to challenge the norms or the standards?
Ty, I don't know if we're trying to challenge the norms or the standards. I think that with the young people that we're working with, we are validating their existence. We're validating their brilliance. We're validating their contributions to our community. And as whoever they are, you know, how they show up, we're validating who they are, because that is actually how we build leaders who then can be strong enough, confident enough to challenge the status quo. But in terms of the media itself, we're just looking at helping these young people and working with young people in a way that they really harness the power of community, that they understand how powerful our community is, that they have opportunity to have real conversations with grassroots leaders, with elected officials, with policymakers, with activists in the community, with many unsung heroes. So they have a really big picture of this community. And through understanding the community and who is who and who's doing what and the value of young people and feeling valued, then we know that they start to experience and fall in love with our community. And it's through this falling in love that this essence of wanting to serve becomes very strong. And so we are helping and building the next leaders of New Mexico who come from a place of service and understanding and have already had their ear to the ground, if you will, from this community. So challenging, I think, like, there's ways that we teach young people that there's two ways of doing journalism. One is like mainstream media. And one of the things I just want us to remember and how we teach this is that there's like six human beings, billionaires, who own the majority of mainstream media in this country. And because they're owners of that of those media outlets and newspapers and radio stations, you have to really question how much that their influence is in the narratives that are being told. So we help and train young people to really understand the power of narrative and understand what are false narratives that are existing right now in media and have existed historically, and then what are narratives that are really coming from our community, and how do we listen deeply to the folks that we interview and that we get trained from and that interface with us in a number of different ways. How do we listen deeply so that we're hearing what is the narrative of the community, and how do young people build their own personal narrative to understand their own, to understand and really love their own identities? And then how does that create a community narrative? So we look at narrative. We look at what are false narratives? Where do they come from? We look at journalism in general. I know that there's times that we have young journalists come and work with us, and you know, they have been taught in journalism school, which we respect, and they're saying this is AP style. But our question to them is, but who is the AP? So who is the AP made up of? And does the makeup of the AP represent our community? So those are like some of the critical questions that we ask. And that's not to, you know, knock all AP journalists or anything, but I think we have to look at the structures and the systems that media comes from. Media has been the tool of upholding white supremacy and status quo, but media has also been the tool, and a media justice frame has been the tool for holding our communities and helping to harness that power of our community and by telling those stories.
So what are some of the false narratives that you've encountered that work to uphold these problematic structures?
Well, I think that there's so many, but to the narratives that uphold the structures, I think in terms of...
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, have you encountered any of these false narratives during this time of protests for racial justice or as a COVID-19 has?
Yeah, I'm trying to decide which one to talk about in some ways, Ty, because they're all so loaded. But there's a false narrative right now that all of the protesters are rioters and that they're all violent protests. Like, that's a false narrative that we're seeing just even a couple of days ago. We saw how it erupted on mainstream media. And that's really a false narrative. And, you know, like, even in terms of the presidential debate, I was disappointed that Chris Wallace didn't ask for, like, when some of that was getting spouted out, I was disappointed that there wasn't clarification. Like, you know, it's been proven that some of the people who have actually started the fires, starting, breaking into buildings, all of that kind of stuff, were not even the protesters. They were infiltrators. One was even a police officer. And so when we're not countering those false narratives with facts and truth and accuracy, then those false narratives continue to grow. And it is media's responsibility to counter false narratives. Otherwise, you're perpetuating false narratives. And so there's so many that we could look at this moment. But, you know, there's narratives also, I think, that we have to be full aware of that are really dog whistles. And they're dog whistles against young people of color. Like, that's who's being targeted by what is being said. And when those narratives aren't countered, that's a problem. If I want to just go back to a couple of days ago at the presidential debate, the other thing that happened is that Chris Wallace started the conversation about racism and structural and systemic racism as, you know, as it's showing up today in various ways. Let's talk about race versus let's talk about structural and systemic racism. Mm-hmm. So those are two different topics. And once you say, let's talk about race, well, it puts the onus on communities of color and people of color to then be on the defensive. And because we're not talking about race, we're talking about the impacts, historic impacts of racism. And so those are some just direct examples of how these narratives play themselves out, and how if there's not somebody countering those narratives, and narrative is such an incredible and powerful and beautiful thing that, you know, we have narratives, we just live in these narratives all the time. We inhale them. We're like, you know, the goldfish and the little goldfish pot, we don't even realize that we're in it. And so we start believing the narratives. And this is where narrative work is so important. And a lot of what we do is narrative work at Generation Justice for this reason, is helping to really look at, is this true? What do you really believe? And helping the young people to, and our community through our work, to really have some critical thinking skills about what is being said about us, written about our community in general, or community. Is it really true? How do we find fair and accurate information data that helps us know what is truth, what has truth in it, and what is like a stretch of the truth that then is really being a dog whistle to bring fear and anxiety into our society.
And tell me about the work of countering that. I mean, a lot of what you're talking about sounds like it's about working to bring members of the communities that are being reported on to a position where they're reporting about themselves. Is that accurate?
Absolutely, yeah. Having people tell their own story in their own words. You know, in mainstream media, in a lot of ways, how journalism schools at times teach is that time is of essence. Journalism is elite, and time is of essence. And so everything's fast, 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 quick, quick, quick. And so, you know, I've been interviewed several times by mainstream media. They come in, they set up their cameras, I get 5 minutes, and from that 5 minutes, they give me 30 seconds of my own voice in a soundbite, and then they interpret the rest of what I've said.
Right. Oh, we are going to have to go to a break right now. We'll be right back with Roberta in a moment. You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. And this morning we're talking about diversity in news and how the whiteness of journalism, of the journalism industry, has failed communities of color. We are taking your calls, 277-5866, or you can send us an email with your comments at letstalk@kunm.org. We're going to a break.
Chacon Clavarenga is an American guitarist named after the Chacon by Bach. Coming up, we'll hear Bach's Chacon and the guitarist with a wonderfully musical name who's becoming a major artist in her own right. Bach's Chacon and Chacon Clavarenga on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Next time on the Children's Hour, get blown away with us as we learn all about balloons. From hot air balloons to latex balloon art and clothing, we cover it all, including weather balloons and what happens when you release that helium balloon into nature.
It's all in an hour.
The Children's Hour, Kids Public Radio.
I love the Children's Hour.
Saturdays, 9 to 10 a.m. right here on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. Right now I'm speaking with Roberto Rael of Generation Justice. And I'd also like to bring into this conversation Dr. Ilya Rodriguez, the director of the master's program at UNM School of Communication and Journalism. Good morning, Dr. Rodriguez.
Good morning.
So we've been talking a lot about narrative with Roberto Rael, and I know in your work you talk about the fact that since the 1970s, American journalism has made a lot of strides towards covering issues relevant to non-dominant, non-white culture, but even in the narrative of those works, you often find biases towards white America. How so?
Yes. Some of my research has looked at precisely what are those dominant narratives in news reporting that focuses specifically on racial and other forms of cultural difference and diversity. And what I've found is that beyond the issue of biases, right, liberal or conservative bias, these dominant narratives are shaped by what I call the liberal discourse of multiculturalism. And when I refer to liberal multiculturalism, what I'm talking about is a perspective that is a larger ideological lens, right, that is reproduced in this particular or through this particular narrative, and that transcends, as I said, the notion of bias that underlies many of the narratives that I see historically in commercial mainstream news media. So this lens is one that conceives the nation, right, in terms of, yes, socially advantaged cultural majorities, disadvantaged minorities. It is a lens that allows for the recognition of difference, conflict, even injustice, and even looks at barriers, right, that are systemic and structural. But this lens privileges, right, the individual pursuit of rights, educational achievement, social mobility as the ways to address systemic inequality.
That it's up to the individual.
Pursuit of rights.
So this narrative sort of emphasizes that it's up to the individual to go and get these things rather than for the system to alter. Is that right?
Yes. Again, it's a way of reporting that makes it very difficult to address and neglects and undermines, right, collective experience, systemic histories of systemic oppression, and structural change.
Now, Roberta, I want to go back to you real quick. Is that something that that you work with the youth in your program to draw attention to, this this dichotomy between telling a story about people pursuing their individual rights versus communities or even structures changing to be more equitable?
Absolutely. And good morning to you, Dr. Rodriguez. So Dr. Rodriguez is an incredible professor who has worked with us and our young people in a variety of ways. And what she's talking about is exactly what we do at Generation Justice as a praxis. And so when you bring together the theory and and the practice, it's really a powerful thing, as subtle as it can be in the practice of it.
Okay. And, you know, one of the narrative myths, of course, that we have here in the United States, and by myth, I mean this guiding narrative, is the idea of the American dream. Dr. Rodriguez, could you kind of tell me what is the American dream in this context, and how does that narrative work against centering communities of color in our reporting?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it is, in fact, a central master narrative in much of this kind of reporting. Sometimes it's more overt, right? And there are even references to the American dream in the quotes they get from immigrants or minority community representatives. Other times it's very much indirect and sort of underlying the structure of the story, right? So again, these notions of equal opportunity, notions of individual effort, and the view of the American dream as a way of negotiating, right, to individual action, negotiating the tensions that gender, class, ethnic, racial tensions pose, right? It's the American dream is a way to reduce the conflictive diversity that we have to a narrative that is easily understood by the mainstream society. So it serves that ideological function in many ways, because it allows to talk about conflict, but at the end of the way, at the end of the story, is about finding those common values that will make the management of diversity possible. And those common values very often are presented as universal values, right? The ones that I mentioned, like individual effort, pursuit of rights, etc., in ways that are not necessarily universal. That are pretty much representative of the experience of European Americans, white European Americans in this country, right? So that's the way in which diversity is sort of filtered and understood through the narrative of the American dream.
Now, Roberta, how is this sort of idea harmful to the communities of color in our country?
Well, it's harmful in so many ways. Again, narratives form beliefs, and then beliefs impact everything, policy, laws, procedures. And so when you have false narratives about one group of people being superior to others, that live in the same community or in the same world, then that's where the systemic and the structural pieces that are so problematic come into play, because, again, policies, procedures, and laws are being set sometimes by false narratives, or the narrative of, like, you know, what essentially is upholding status quo, and that one group of people could actually be more deserving of a good life, of health, of education than other groups of people.
And, you know, we're taking your calls today. What is something that a news story got wrong about your community? You can call 277-5866, correct the record. Right now I have a call from Bill in Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill. What is your comment or question today?
Yes, good morning. I have a comment. We've lost the written word in New Mexico. We're losing the airway words in New Mexico. This in itself is systemic racism. We only have one newspaper in Albuquerque, main newspaper, the Albuquerque Journal. Journal. And even newspapers like The Optic in Las Vegas, they refuse editorial letters from liberal socialist people. They are conservative movements in written and in airways in New Mexico that are extremely strong. It started with the conservative church, and it continues with the conservative government. The conservative church is at tremendous weakness on the poor people.
Thank you so much for calling in today, Bill. So, Dr. Rodriguez, I think Bill is talking about access to journalism as well as a diversity of views being promoted. Is this something that can be seen as a form of systemic racism?
Yes, indeed, because the decline in news, especially local news and community news, as well as larger commercial news outlets, the decline in the number, right, of newspapers and other media ventures in the last 2 decades has been dramatic.
with this comes the reduction of the workforce in journalism, the competition with social media. All these are economic imperatives, structural imperatives that end up limiting the number of voices and the range of voices that are articulated, right? And that can we reach larger audiences. We have a very fragmented conversation where people talk to like-minded people, but that conversation that exposes people to diverse voices, to new information, mm-hmm. to other viewpoints, right? To an understanding what really is socialism. We have a lot of, you know, we see this word thrown around a lot, mm-hmm. and then you look at the sources that talk about socialism, they're not socialists. I mean, where are those voices that can talk with us about mm-hmm. that as a political vision? And this, again, this spectrum is reduced by these economic trends in journalism that end up reinforcing systemic mm-hmm. racism in very indirect ways.
Now, Roberta, you, of course, with Generation Justice, you're working to promote a diversity of voices for the future. And I wondered if you could maybe tell us a little bit about some of the youth that have come through the programs at Generation Justice and what they've gone on to do.
Sure. And I just want to, again, echo what I said earlier. We need to pay attention that if there are 6 billionaires that are owners of all of the mainstream media in this country, it's exactly what Bill and mm-hmm. Dr. Rodriguez were just talking to. If we don't have diversity of opportunities for our community or communities to have platforms to speak and tell stories, then that is definitely problematic. And it's also historic. It's happened time and time mm-hmm. again. For listeners, I just want to let you know that one of the curriculum pieces that we use is a book called News for All the People. The authors are Joe Torres and Juan Gonzalez, and it gives a historic view of journalism in this country, but also journalists of color mm-hmm. Who have tried to maintain the telling the truth of their communities and have gotten wiped out by larger companies. And so that point I just wanted to make. But yeah, so proud of so many of the young people. And young people have gone into a number of fields, early childhood development, teaching, social workers. But in terms of the journalists that have come out of Generation Justice, here's just a few. Jason Fuller, who was one of our first journalism fellows, he is now an assistant producer at NPR with All Things Considered. When you all are listening to All Things Considered, you're probably listening to something that Jason Fuller produced and pitched mm-hmm. for that programming. I've already heard the difference on All Things Considered since he's been in that position. Jonquilin Hill is the producer for NPR's 81A from WAMU. That is a nationally syndicated program. Polly Dinetclaw is Indigenous Affairs reporter out of the Texas Observer, but worked at the Navajo Times for quite some time. Avikra Lucky is a producer at 9 News at KUSA in Denver. Luna Olavarria Gallegos is an impact producer for this amazing piece of work called The Belly of the Beast that she worked out of Cuba. Christina Rodriguez is a digital news reporter for KOB. And Tamar Reed has worked in a number of different places as a CNN intern, C-SPAN intern. She worked for a long time here at Media Desk. And then our own Kateri Zuni, who is the Generation Justice radio producer and produces radio with our young people and our community every single week.
So it's definitely making an impact already.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, we train young people that to respect the industry of journalism mm-hmm. and to respect and kind of like become bilingual and bicultural, just like we are as folks of color and indigenous folks as well, that we live our lives being bilingual, bicultural, and we're code switching all of the time. Mm-hmm. And so it's just another layer of code switching to really understand how journalism is taught, how journalism works, to excel in it, to be the best you can, the best writer that you can, the best reporter that you can, in all of the ways that that is being taught. But also to bring in with it the media justice lens, to know that
this is not your story. Mm-hmm. This is the person's story who you get the privilege of sitting with and listening to. That time is really a gift that is given to all of us. And the more time that you invest in listening to this individual from the community, the better your story is going to be, the richer it's going to be. And to approach the work from really a place of love. And love equals justice.
Well, I love that. Thank you so much for that, Roberta. I'm going to go ahead and bring in, at this point, Sunny Klotchish-Chiligi into the conversation. Now, Sunny has worked for many years as a sports writer for the Navajo Times and has recently been publishing articles in Searchlight New Mexico, Rolling Stone, the New York Times, and The Guardian. Welcome, Sunny.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Sunny, we were just talking a little bit about kind of code switching, and, of course, when you write for the Navajo Nation in the Navajo Times, you're reaching a pretty different audience than with the Rolling Stone. In your own work, how do you change your approach when you're working with that different kind of audience?
I think that it's because it's within the community, there's a more conversational approach to it. And I think that I'm more conscious about that in that way, because I feel like I know my audience a little bit more than, because it's so focused. And so there's a little bit more flexibility. And one of the flexibilities is that it can sound a lot more conversational, and you really are doing more storytelling than spewing facts.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, what is the value of storytelling versus just giving the facts?
Well, I think that when looking at a more central audience like the Navajo Nation, for example, and when I used to be a reporter for the Navajo Times, it's great because there are some levels where you don't have to explain a whole lot because you have such a specific audience, but also that with storytelling, it's a better way for us to connect and to understand things. I mean, I think that it's a fairly well-known fact that oral storytelling is a huge tradition for the Navajo people and Native peoples everywhere. And so when you have storytelling, things just come off so much more fluid and in a much more grasping way.
Mm-hmm. So when you write a story for the, say, Rolling Stone, like you did recently, about experiences with COVID-19 on the Navajo Nation, what do you think that you bring to these stories that a white reporter from another part of the country might miss?
I think experience is definitely a big thing, because you're able to find, from working from within the community, you're able to find sources that are, I think, very unique than what someone else from the outside would be able to find. But also, you know, there's a level of not having to look up so much and having to figure out so much, because when you're there embedded in the community, it's just a lot more easy. It's a lot easier to be able to see what the needs are of the community and what it is that they want from these stories, because I think that's kind of hard to get if you're coming from the outside in.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah, I think that for a lot of the national coverage that was being made on the Navajo Nation in terms of the peak of COVID on the Navajo Nation, we had seen a lot of stories about the disparities, and rightfully so. I mean, those are things that are definitely important, but, you know, people, what was more important for them, I think, was the culture. You know, there was a big shift in culture and how people were looking at things. And, you know, with that, one of my particular stories in The Guardian, it spoke to more, less about those disparities and more about, this is how people are feeling, and this is how people are looking at this, these things could change, and this is how they're responding. So it was less about, you know, this is what the people are dealing with, because that was a given within the community. But we wanted to focus more on what are they feeling, what are they thinking, and how are they responding to what's happening.
Okay, and you are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. We will be back in a moment.
A handful of large pharmaceutical companies are rushing to develop a COVID-19 vaccine. At least three tribes okayed their citizens for voluntary human clinical trials. That's drawing both criticism and praise from community members, testing COVID-19 vaccines on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, next time on Latino USA. The new school year is getting started, and with that comes parents' anxiety over what comes next. The trials and tribulations of being a parent in the times of a global pandemic.
I kind of have days where I feel like I am failing at everything. I'm failing at work, I'm failing at parenting.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We're talking about the value of diversity in journalism and what needs to change about the way our industry currently works. I'm speaking with Sunny Klaschich-Chiligi, and we are just talking about her experiences as a writer who worked for the Navajo Times for many years and now has been reaching a more national or even international audience. Now, Sunny, I'm interested in when you write about things happening on the Navajo Nation for a national or international outlet, do you ever find yourself in conflict with an editor over how you're choosing to tell the story or parts of the story?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, I definitely have a very narrative approach in all of the stories that I write, which can be very difficult because there have been instances where I've had to work with specific organizations, say the New York Times, when I first wrote my first COVID story or COVID-related story. You know, we had some issues in terms of factual information. There's kind of with the Navajo language, there is kind of a general knowing of things, but you know, with the New York Times, they're very heavy on fact checking mm-hmm. and things like that. And so there were some things that I had to switch up in that article to meet the demands of the mainstream media, or in this case, the New York Times. And so there are some compromises that have to be made. Fortunately, that's less of a case when I work with local media, I've noticed. But yeah, there is definitely a difference.
And then kind of from the other side, in your story that you wrote about Navajo elders for Searchlight New Mexico, you wound up running into some friction with the community, maybe even getting shut out for discussing some of the issues that affect Diné seniors. How do you navigate a situation like that?
I think that it's just important to understand and put yourself in other people's position in that case, because when you come from the community that I come from, the Navajo Nation, there's a big emphasis on family and relations. And so I think that becomes first and foremost before being a journalist, before being any of those other things. And so I recognize that. So when in that particular case, when I was shut out by these people, I looked at it more in terms of what were their jobs? What were they trying to do? And, you know, what am I trying to do? And just kind of looking at it from all angles and trying to understand it instead of taking it for something that is completely negative. Because I think there's a lot of understanding that needs to happen. And for me, I understood that. I understood what their roles were, how they were responding, why they were responding. And so taking it less personal and just understanding those roles, I guess, is kind of where I came from in that instance. And that's really just a reflection of the culture and mm-hmm. and the norms within the culture.
And it seems like by being plugged into that community, it allows you to kind of navigate that situation in a way, whereas a reporter from elsewhere might just kind of dismiss it entirely.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of value in being able to be from the community and embedded in the community, because then you know how things work. You know how people value specific things, specific relationships. You know, because what's not in that column is what led up to that point. What mm-hmm. was that conversation like in the first place? And how do I look at it moving forward? And for me, it's just, you know, it's a new page as we move forward and different things will be discussed and I may have to refer to that source again, but you know, it's just kind of less focusing on, you know, this is what happened, why did it happen this way, and being, you know, upset. It's just not worth it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's because to me at the end of the day, what's important is being able to tell the story, and whether or not some people want to help me do that is really just up to them.
Right. Now we are taking your calls this morning. I'd love to know what stories you wish we covered more or differently, especially stories about your community. You can call 277-5866 and join this conversation. Right now I'm speaking with Sunny Klaatjes Chilligi, and we are going to bring into the conversation Russell Contreras. Russell has been a reporter for over 20 years, writing for outlets like the Albuquerque Journal and the Boston Globe, and he served as the president of Unity, Journalists for Diversity. Currently, he works for the Associated Press and is responsible for many of the stories covering the Southwest beat that appear all over the country. Good morning, Russell.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Well, I think we're doing pretty good here. Now, you've been advocating for diversity in newsrooms for a long time. How have you seen things change since you started as a reporter?
Well, I've seen some improvements, but they have not kept up with the parity of how this country's demographics are changing. When I started as a reporter, I usually was the only person of color when I entered a newsroom. In fact, many times I was, whether it was the only Latino, only African-American, or Asian-American. And that continued up until the mid-2000s. And I think we started when here in Albuquerque, you do have, you do see more people of color, but even here, Minneapolis is definitely not anywhere near parity. We struggle to get and retain Native American journalists, Latino journalists, and African American journalists. And this is going across the country. I've seen improvements among the hiring of women more. We're still, again, not at parity where we should be. But in terms of journalists of color, we've been stagnant for many years, and in fact have seen our numbers decline as media outlets lay off journalists, as media companies contract, and we have seen very little growth in our management area in newsroom outlets. We don't have a lot of producers, we don't have a lot of editors, and we definitely don't have a lot of people in positions of power. So I think what's now is the pressure is building as we undergo a racial reckoning that media companies need to reflect the communities they cover.
Now, why is it that this industry, which, you know, a lot of people think of as fairly sensitive to trends in this country, why do you think it's been so slow to adapt to exactly what you're talking about?
I think, you know, even though you may have a sympathetic ethos in our newsrooms, we still are dealing with systemic racism, and that permeates in our newsrooms. That's across the board. When I was at Place, at various newsrooms, I've seen a lot of folks give a lot of lip service to covering the communities, but then you didn't have the position of power where they can make a difference. And I think we're starting to see that as we take a step back and analyze how we use mugshots, for example, how we write stories about people of color getting arrested and not doing follow-up to say if that person was, there's no charges were thrown out, or the case they were dismissed in a jury by their peers. These are things that, small things that even I myself started to practice because I saw that was the way it was done. And so now even myself in my own coverage, I'm starting to reflect, okay, is this news? This is something we've done for years, and this is something I've been trained. Am I perpetuating this stereotype? So I think, you know, we're having this recognition, and because the demographics are changing under pressure, quite frankly, we have a new generation of young folks who aren't putting up with it anymore. I'm a Gen Xer. Millennials followed me, and now we have a Gen Z who's coming up and saying the same things our baby boomers were saying when they created the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, the National Association of Black Journalists, and the Native American Journalists Association. Now they're saying, you guys put these structures in order. Let's get to it, and let's diversify our newsrooms.
Now, the Associated Press, whom you work for, is kind of the gold standard of what many people think of as journalism with a capital J. Do you see these issues that we've been discussing play out in the Associated Press's coverage?
Yeah, you know, interesting enough, years ago, we started the race and ethnicity team by Sonia Ross, one of the first Black correspondents to cover the White House. She and Jesse Holland and Suzanne Gamboa, my mentor, started this team to really start thinking about issues of race beyond it being integrated in, say, education or politics. And take a step back, and this team has developed over the years into a strong group of folks, and we've actually had new hires. Aaron Morrison out of New York is one. Kat Stafford is another out of Detroit. And what the team does, and I myself as a member of this team, we look at the issues going on here and try to focus more of an enterprise beat of how we should cover something, whether it's something Donald Trump says or something that's happening with business. I do these things called AP Explains that I take a hit, like some recording event, and give you historic context, for example, mm-hmm. the history of lynching or the history of police shootings involving Latinos, for example. That sometimes gets overlooked in our conversation. So these are things that we've done over the years that I think we've made a difference in mm-hmm. trying to integrate new voices into the conversation.
Now, I'd like to go back to Sunny real quick here. Now, Sunny, as a journalist who's been working with mainstream industry, do you ever feel that there are practices that are detrimental to fair reporting about your community?
Absolutely, and all the time, especially in the Native American community. I think that oftentimes, for one thing, we're just kind of left out of the conversation and of a lot of topics, and especially on the national level. And so once we do get some of that coverage, a lot of it is focused on things that misrepresent us or don't represent us in the best of light. And so I think it exists in any community that is very small, perhaps very rural, and really just kind of off of the grid and just kind of an afterthought. So I think mm-hmm. it's definitely there.
Okay, and Russell, do you see that sort of thing as well?
I do too. Well, when we integrate new voices, automatically, just by default of our own experiences, it changes how we cover things. Now, we do come with our set of privileges since we are journalists and it is a middle class profession. Mm-hmm. But I think it's from which the communities we come from that we're going to give a new set of eyes. When Sunny goes out to Navajo Nation, she sees things that, say, for example, I wouldn't see mm-hmm. if I were to go to the same place. Sunny and I have laughed over a number of times because we know that when outsiders come to the Navajo Nations, one of the first things they always see and always stress are all the red dogs. They say, I can't believe dogs are treated so badly here. Forget the plumbing. Forget that this woman next door has no plumbing. Or she's struggling with poverty. They keep focusing on the dogs.
Right.
And the dogs aren't the story. The people aren't the story. And this is something that we laugh at consistently when everybody, if you give somebody from New York or somebody from California and they go into the Navajo Reds, on the Hopi Nation, Hopi Land, for example, they immediately take photos of the dog. and although that may be jarring for some who have never experienced a number of animals walking around like that, they tend to take away the humanity of the folks they're supposed to be covering. And I think that's something that we consistently joke about, but in many ways it makes us angry. I don't know how Sunny feels, but I always get angry when I see that phenomenon.
Is that something you've noticed as well, Sunny?
Absolutely. I mean, the focus is very interesting to see. I mean, it's very much represented in the end product of what perhaps a news outlet comes in or a newspaper outlet comes in and focuses on. And you can definitely see the difference in how perhaps local journalists kind of view things and kind of what our focuses are on. And it can be very novel for those who come in from the outside.
Now, I'd like to go back to Dr. Elio Rodriguez of the UNM School of Communication and Journalism. Dr. Rodriguez, are you still there? Okay, I think we lost Dr. Rodriguez right now. But well, one thing I wanted to talk about was the idea of two sides to every story. I feel like this is something that a lot of people who are this isn't necessarily something that every journalist thinks to themselves, but certainly when people think about journalism, they think, well, people need to tell both sides of the story. And I wanted to talk to our guests a little bit about their take on that. And I'd like to start with Roberta Rael from Generation Justice.
So thank you. We train around fairness and accuracy, mm-hmm. and I think we have to look at what does it mean by both sides of the story. And so if you have mainstream media all covering the story from the perspectives that Russell and Sunny have just spoken of that aren't giving the full side of the story or aren't honoring the humanity of the story. And so if you have one tiny little outlet that is telling it the story differently, what's the balance of that story or what is like mm-hmm. both sides of the story? Is it trying to get like what we consider pretty much false activity within one story? So you're looking at this side and that side, but that's also like not really how the world works. Mm-hmm. There's not just, it's not white and black. There's a whole lot of gray.
in every situation in our lives. And so we look more at training around a balanced story and looking at balanced media in general. And so, again, you've got lots of other outlets that are covering narratives from stories from a particular narrative. And so it's important that we have other places that can tell the other aspects of that story and help raise those other narratives that are so important to be heard. Mm-hmm. For, again, I loved how Russell talked about the humanity of it, because it really is about the humanity of it. And so I think when journalists are taught about objectivity and then it gets interpreted as two sides of the story, mm-hmm. it's really about balance. There's a study on some of our narrative work that was conducted a bit ago on our narrative shift on the behavioral health crisis. And that study broke it down in terms of how we heard the stories and told the stories of the people that we interviewed and how mainstream media locally had told those stories. Mm-hmm. And it got broken out into pie graphs. And the pie graph for Generation Justice's work was like this beautiful pie graph that had almost equal colors of the graph of the pie pieces versus the majority of how mainstream media focused on the behavioral health crisis was really looking at it from an economic standpoint and a policy standpoint, but not really hardly covering suicide, hardly covering family distress. Mm. And so the way that we have a balanced story and we present then to our community balance is being able to know that it is not white and black. It is mm-hmm. not only two sides. There's a lot of complexity in the world that we live in and in the human beings that we get the opportunity to interview and talk with.
And now, Dr. Rodriguez, I believe you are back now. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so just real quick, we've got about
disconnected there for a moment.
That's quite all right. We've got about a minute left, and I'd like to just ask you about what Roberta was saying. What is the harmful aspect of reducing stories into, you know, two sides to every story versus the kind of multiplicity that Roberta Rael was speaking of?
Yes, I think to what Roberta was saying, I think that's creation of a binary, mm-hmm. two sides of the story. Also creates false equivalences, where we tend to think that, for instance, these protests and the social unrest around police brutality is a good example. So you have very often this division between the white supremacists and on one side, Black Lives Matter activism, on the other side, so protesters versus white supremacists, mm-hmm. as if there were two sides equally dangerous, right, equally threatening as agents of violence, and as if their views and their influence and power somewhat, right, is equated as a binary.
And I'm so sorry to have to cut you off here. The music started and we've run out of time and it just went so quickly today. Thank you to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests, Roberta Rael of Generation Justice, Dr. Ilya Rodriguez from the UNM School of Communication and Journalism, Sunny Klatches-Chiligi of Searchlight New Mexico, and Russell Contreras of the Associated Press. This conversation doesn't have to end here and it won't end here. Share your thoughts on Twitter, hashtag Let's Talk NM, on Facebook, or email letstalk@kunm.org. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Kaveh Mova had screened your calls. Taylor Velasquez live tweeted the show today, and Hannah Colton is our executive producer. I'm Ty Bannerman, and this is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.